we continue to sit here together quietly, I would like to invite you to join me in a very simple Pali chant. And the day that we have here today is to commemorate the life of the Buddha. And it's said that the life and the practice and the teachings of the Buddha were for the sake and benefit and for the happiness and for the salvation of all beings and all people. And I find it great inspiration that a gathering like we have here in Palo Alto on Monday evenings, this particular gathering of people, a combination of people practicing together, would not have been here at all if it hadn't been for the life, the practice, and realization and teaching of this person 2,500 years ago. And for 2,500 years we've been supported, or this practice has been supported by countless beings, people. And that Buddhism is usually transmitted from person to person. And the teachers that we've known, they knew their teachers. And those teachers knew their teachers. And it goes back through individuals, a kind of a direct transmission, somehow or other, through living human beings back to this person, the Shakyamuni Buddha. And at the heart of the teachings and the practices of the Buddha is the expression of loving kindness, the wish for loving kindness, for happiness and the well-being of all people everywhere. So we can start by, to honor or commemorate the Buddha, it might be nice to start by chanting the short chant of loving kindness, of metta. And it goes, the first word is sabbe, and sabbe means all. And the second word is satta, and satta means beings. And the third word is sukhi, which means happiness. And the fourth word is hontu, which means something like may they be. So may all beings be happy. So I'll chant one word at a time. And then you can join after you hear the chant, the word. Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Satta.
Satta.
Sukhi. Sabbe,
sabbe,
satta,
satta,
sukhi,
sukhi,
hontu,
hontu.
And then let's try a whole line at a time. Sabbe, satta, sukhi.
Sabbe Sata Sugi Hondu Sabbe Sata Sugi Hondu Sabbe Sata Sugi Hondu Sabbe Sata Sugi Hondu.
So, good evening.
Good evening.
And today is the day we commemorate or celebrate the life of the Buddha, the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, and his death. And I have here in front of me a statue of the baby Buddha, and shortly after he was born, and the story goes that his mother was on her way home to her parents' home to give birth. And on the way there, she stopped in a beautiful grove of woods to rest underneath the canopy of a wonderful tree and in the nice, comfortable, warm spring weather. And there, on the way home, standing, holding a branch, she gave birth to the Buddha. And as she gave birth to him, the Buddha was caught by four devas, by four gods. And these four gods then caught the Buddha and then gently placed him down on a large lotus blossom. And then he immediately proceeded to take seven steps. And each step, a lotus blossom appeared under each step to receive the foot. So seven lotus blossoms. And he took seven steps to the north. And then he pointed his finger, one finger up towards the sky, and you see it down here in the statue, and one finger down to the earth. And then he declared, "Heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one." And it's kind of a wonder that such events should happen. But I think birth is always a wonder. It's a time, to really marvel at almost the magic of life. And I think any birth is a kind of belongs to the wonder of life. And part of, I think, of growing up as a child is to live with eyes of wonder. To see the world without prejudice or without prejudgment or without evaluation or criticism or bias, and see the world, fresh for the first time, just explore the world with these big, wide, open eyes. And what is this? To kind of receive everything, to be open as a wonder. And so he was born in this kind of precocious manner. And the symbolism of the Buddha saying, heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one, the significance of it is that each of us should be able to say that for ourselves and not feel that we're being arrogant. Each of us should feel like we're special, like each of us is unique, and we have this inherent sense of self-worth, inherent worthfulness, just for being alive as a human being on this world. And that there's something so special about each one single individual on this world that no amount of doing or being some special identity or whatever can overshadow this wonderful, it does overshadow for most of us, but at the core of who we are is our Buddha, our Buddhahood, our Buddha nature. And part of Buddhist practice is to find a perspective for ourselves where we can, with some honesty, say for ourselves, heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one. And it'd be wonderful if all of us could say that, wouldn't it? And we'd all be in harmony. So then, so the Buddhist father was slightly concerned, I suppose, by this kind of wondrous birth. And so he invited a great sage to come visit him and kind of explain what was going on. And the sage explained that this baby would grow up to either become a world-ruling monarch or a Buddha. Every father, I guess, most fathers want their kids to follow the family business and not go into religion, usually. So his father protected the Buddha from all kind of forces, all kind of experiences that might trigger some kind of existential angst, that where he might want to go off and explore, you know, in a spiritual quest. So he built three palaces, each one for each of the seasons in India: the wet season, the cool season, I guess, and the hot season. And the Buddha would spend his life in these three wonderful palaces with great gardens, with great kind of estates, with all the possible sports and activities that a young man could want, and all the possible pleasures that a young man could want. And there's wonderful descriptions of the 40,000 women in his harem. And just so that he would just enjoy himself and live this wonderful life. And the father took great pains to keep everyone who was sick, really old, or who was dead, out of the sight of the Buddha, outside the palace walls, so the Buddha would not have to see any of these kinds of difficult sights that is inherent to being a human being and to human life. And in some ways, it's kind of like what it was like growing up in the suburbs of Los Angeles for many of us. So, but at some point when he was 29 years old, he somehow managed to venture forth outside the walls. And there the first time he ventured forth, he encountered a sick person, which he had never seen before. And he asked his attendant, "What is that?" And his attendant said, "Oh, that's a sick person. It's the nature of all people to become sick sooner or later. And sooner or later it'll happen to you." And he said, "Oh." And he went back to his palace. And next time he ventured forth, he saw a old person. And he was told the same thing. It's the nature of all people to get old. And then next time he went forth, he saw a dead person. And he was told, it's the nature of all people, and it'll happen to you also, to some point or other, to die. And this was a great revelation, a shock to him in a sense. And then he went out a fourth time, and the fourth time he saw a renunciant, a monastic person, with a shaved head and wearing robes and carrying a begging bowl. And this person had this wonderful serenity and peace about them. And so the Buddha was inspired and asked, you know, what is that? And he was explained, this is a person who has left the home life in order to find peace or find, you know, a resolution to the quest of problems of suffering. So the Buddha then was inspired to do that. And so he, I guess in the middle of the night, without anybody knowing it except for his attendant, he left his palace and left his life of a prince and went off into the world. And it's often pointed out by people, people sometimes complain that the Buddha at this point abandoned his family. He was living in the palace, he had a wife, and he just had a newborn son. And, you know, it's, you know, Newt Gingrich wouldn't be happy at all. So, you know, it's kind of, it seems terrible to abandon your family this way. And perhaps it is. I'm not going to justify it. However, considering, the kind of life he had lived, this pampered life inside the palace walls, that was very much removed from reality itself, from the real world, the real confrontation with the real, some important issues of life. I kind of see that his choice to leave the palace was not so much, abandoning the world, but rather choosing to enter the world in a more honest way. And I see it also, I don't know if it's exactly fair, but kind of parallel to the book of Genesis, where there's also, in both stories, there's kind of acquisition of knowledge. The Buddha, the knowledge was sickness, old age, and death. And Genesis, we don't know what it was, just knowledge. And whereas in the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden and banished. Whereas in the Buddha story, he chooses to leave the garden. And he chooses to go out and actually engage himself with the world. Engage himself with the world of suffering, the pain, sickness, old age, and death, in order to find some kind of, perhaps, resolution to it, some kind of freedom in the midst of it, or some awakening to it. So he ventured forth and into the world as a renunciant, as a mendicant. And it's said that he spent many years, some 6-7 years, intensely practicing the various religious practices of India of his times. And a lot of those years was as an ascetic. And he outperformed all the other ascetics around him. And he got to a point where he was kind of went into a river to drink or something. And he stumbled and almost couldn't get himself to stand up and leave. And he realized that he was on the edge of death. And if he pushed himself any more in the ascetic route, he would have died. And there was no point to that. There was no solution just in dying. So he decided that this wasn't the way. And so what he did was he took his mendicant bowl and he placed it, he kind of felt discouraged. He didn't know what to do. So he wanted some omen of encouragement. So he took his mendicant bowl and placed it in the river. And instead of flowing downriver with the current, the bowl flowed up against the current, upriver. And he took that as an encouraging sign. And the symbol of this for me is that at some point, a practice of awakening, a practice of really becoming sensitive to the suffering and the joys and the deep interconnectedness of life goes against the currents of popular culture. And practice will actually will float us in the other direction. And that's why it's very important to have a sangha of people to support us, because it can be very difficult to go against the popular consumer or whatever culture. And then he remembered the time when he was a child. When he was 6 years old, he was kind of left kind of for a few minutes, I guess, on this edge of the field where his father was presiding over the spring plowing festival. And so he was a baby Buddha, a young kid, was forgotten under a rose apple tree. And he sat up in this kind of posture, and maybe for the first time or whatever, he left himself alone. He was left alone by other people who maybe were always pampering him, but he left himself alone. He didn't try to do anything or be anything or try to change anything. He just opened his mind with this great openness, maybe of a child, childlike openness to the wonder of just being alive. And in that state of wonder and leaving himself unconditionally alone, he experienced a great joy that's said in Buddhism to be an unconditioned joy, not dependent on having things or things external or being anybody special. It just comes from leaving ourselves alone. It's a wonderful thing about Buddhist practice. If you can really learn to leave yourself alone, there's this flowering of joy that'll happen by itself. It's our innate nature almost. If you give ourselves half the chance for joy to arise, it will. So when he was 36 then, he remembered this time when he was 6. He said, maybe this is the way to proceed. So he decided to sit underneath a Bodhi tree and to sit with the same kind of childlike openness that he had when he was 6 and see what happened. And as many of you know, when you sit this way and be somewhat open, you're visited by many forces that makes it actually very difficult to stay open. So we have this story of what happened to the Buddha. So the Buddha to be, he wasn't a Buddha yet, the Bodhisattva, Siddhartha, he placed himself with a firm resolve beneath the Bodhi tree and straightway was approached by Mara, the god of lust and death. The dangerous god appeared mounted on an elephant and carrying weapons in his 1,000 hands. He was surrounded by his army, which extended 12 leagues before him, 12 to the right, 12 to the left, and in the rear, as far as the confines of the world, it was 9 leagues high. The protecting deities of the universe took flight, but the future Buddha remained unmoved beneath the tree, and the god then assailed him, seeking to break his concentration. Whirlwind, rocks, thunder and flame, smoking weapons with keen edges, burning coals, hot ashes, boiling mud, blistering sands, and fourfold darkness. Sound like your meditation? The antagonist hurled against the Savior, but the missiles were all transformed into celestial flowers and ointments by the power of the Buddha's 10 perfections. Mara then deployed his daughters, desire, pining, and lust, surrounded by voluptuous attendants, but the mind of the great being was not distracted. The god finally challenged his right, the god, Mara, finally challenged the Buddha's right to be sitting on that spot under the Bodhi tree. And he flung his razor-sharp discus angrily and bid the towering host of the army to let fly at him with mountain crags. But the future Buddha only moved his hand to touch the ground with his fingertips and thus bid the goddess Earth to bear witness to his right to be sitting where he was. She did so with 100, 1,000, 100,000 roars so that the elephant of the antagonist fell upon its knees in obedience to the future Buddha. The army was immediately dispersed, and the gods of all the world scattered garlands. This is a wonderful story, kind of myth of the Buddha's enlightenment, and visited by all the psychic forces of temptations, of desire, of fear, of aversion, of denial, of repression, all these things that to kind of keep us from keeping our childlike openness. And the quality, I think, that the Buddha had, in addition to the childlike openness that we all try to have in our sitting, was an adult-like steadiness. And the combination of a childlike openness and adult-like steadiness is the combination that we need for our practice. And many of us in California have learned a lot about the inner child, and we also need to learn about the inner adult. And the combination of these two. And then he sat under that tree through the night and attained his awakening, his enlightenment. It said that he saw the morning star, and in seeing the morning star, he was illuminated, freed from the forces of Mara. It said that he overcame the sting of death, is one definition of his enlightenment. And then he continued then for 7 weeks in his meditation, underneath the Bodhi tree, in the area around the Bodhi tree, just enjoying the bliss and the joy and the insights of his enlightenment, of his awakening. Wondering whether it was possible to teach anybody what he'd learned. And he had his serious doubts that anybody would understand this nature of freedom that he discovered. But he decided, luckily for us, that this is something that could be conveyed. So he set forth to find his 5 earlier companions in spiritual life, thinking that they would be suitable people for him to teach. And he sat them down with them, and the first sermon that he then taught was a sermon on the 4 Noble Truths. And I think this is beautiful. I had this beautiful image of the Buddha. You can imagine this person who was totally enlightened and full of joy and rapture, sitting for 7 weeks just in bliss and rapture. And I'm sure he was kind of still radiant and shining in his wonderful way. And great, you know, delight to see him. And full of delight, this person. And then he starts talking about suffering. He says, there is this thing of suffering exists in the world. We can't deny it. It isn't that all of life is suffering, but we find that we feel suffering, there's suffering around us. But there's a cause, there's a reason for that suffering to come about. And understanding that cause for the suffering is a very key part to a spiritual life. and being interested in suffering, being interested to investigate it, to understand its roots, its causes, its conditions, is really the essential thing in a Buddhist spiritual life. Not to be morbid, not to be depressive or because it's a downer, but rather because it's the possibility of being free. So this first noble truth is of suffering, the second is the cause of suffering is clinging or thirst, and the third then is the possibility of freedom, the end of suffering. And the fourth thing they taught was a path to practice, the Eightfold Path, a way of behaving, a way of living in the world that is most conducive for understanding the world of joy, of freedom, and penetrating the issue of suffering. So I think it's just juxtaposition of this totally radiant person and teaching about suffering. So I want to tell you the story about a friend of mine who, I think she said she lived down here near Palo Alto in 1965, went to high school. And she, it was time, I guess, of the Haight-Ashbury and LSD and marijuana. And she had heard that there was this guy up in San Francisco, the Zen master, who can teach you how to get high naturally. And so they thought that was pretty interesting. So they went up to see Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco, and these 15-year-old girls, young women, and asked them, you know, how do you get high naturally? And he then proceeded to give them a discourse on the Four Noble Truths, on suffering. And this is not what these 15-year-olds wanted to hear. But there was this man, Suzuki Roshi, was so full of joy as he was speaking about suffering that something didn't kind of click for her, something really. And so she thought this was really something she needed to investigate or learn more about. And then she proceeded for the next, I think now it's been 31 years, to be a Zen Buddhist practitioner. Beautiful story. So the Buddha also is, the first sermon on the Four Noble Truths. And it said that the Four Noble Truths, any child, can learn what they are, but to really understand the profundity of them is, only takes a fully enlightened person. So it was enlightenment. And then after 45 years or so of teaching, wandering around India as a mendicant monk, he then at some point relinquished his hold on life. And when he was about 80 or so years old, he then laid himself down like this wonderful statue up here in that posture. This is a statue of the Buddha's passing away, his death. And so he laid himself down, and before he died, he asked all his students, all his disciples, if they had any questions that they wanted to ask before he passed away, any last questions. And no one said anything. And he said, please, don't, out of respect for me, hold back any questions you might have. This is really important. Now is your last chance. And again, no one had any questions, so he said, fine. And he gave a little sermon. And the end of the sermon, he said, all things have the nature to be impermanent. Practice diligently. And then he lay down like this. And then he entered into his meditation. And in the course of his meditation, he just passed away. And we usually don't say the Buddha died because it's complicated, but it's one of the things that cannot be talked about or cannot be understood is what happens to a Buddha after Buddha dies. You can't say the Buddha disappears or vanishes, and you can't say the Buddha continues. So what do you say? You better not say anything. And so this day today, the Vesak celebration, is a day where Theravada Buddhism celebrates the birth, the enlightenment, and the death of the Buddha. And I used to kind of say that it was kind of cute because the Theravada tradition is a very kind of a minimalist tradition, and so it's kind of nice to put all the holidays into one day and kind of get it over with and then get back to work. But I think lately I've been thinking there's another way of seeing this. It's actually it can be seen as a deep teaching to have all three of these events celebrated on the same day. because they're intertwined with each other. And they shouldn't be seen as separate. And a lot of the suffering that sometimes occurs to us is when we see these three as being separate events. That birth in itself entails death. Anything that gets born, anything that comes into being at some point is going to go out of being, is going to die. And so we have to know that and take that into account. And if we don't, if we expect, you know, eternal life, we're asking for suffering. So understand this close interconnectedness of life and death. And the wonderful story that maybe I've told maybe too many times of one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein. I asked him if he ever married anyone, because sometimes meditation teachers do that. And he said, yes, but he preferred not to do that. He likes to be a retreat teacher. But the first time he did it, he gave a sermon on Dharma talk on death. And I don't know, I used to think that that was because he kind of wanted to discourage anybody from asking him again. But there's also, I think, again, something profound about that. That when you marry someone, you in our culture, it usually means you marry them for life. Or at least that's the intention. And then the idea is that if that's the case, chances are extremely good that one of you is going to die before the other. And that's part of what you're buying into, what you're joining into in that event of marriage. And so, not to take it as a downer, but rather maybe as a way to appreciate life and the relationships and much more deeply. At least that's the idea. The reflection on death in Buddhism is supposed to be for the greater appreciation of life and for straightening out our priorities about what's really important. So this is a day we celebrate. And I hope each of you can say for yourself, heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one. And that each of you will understand that just as life and death are intertwined and inseparable, so the world of awakening and freedom is intertwined and inseparable from the world of life and death. But it's like a lotus flower, it says, that flowers through it and becomes this radiant white flower that arises kind of through in the midst of the world of life and death. So there's too many of us here for us to do kind of a ritual where all of us come up to bathe the baby Buddha. But we'll do a little bit of chanting, and I'll bathe the baby Buddha for you. And then when we finish, we'll take we'll stop and I guess there's some refreshments outside in the hall. We're not supposed to have food or drink in this room here, but then there's a chance for us to hang out a little bit and greet each other before we go home. We'll end a little bit early tonight so we can do that. And maybe just then also to make just a couple of announcements. That this Wednesday starts the refuge class for those of you who would like to come, and there's more said about that in our newsletter, the little brochure we have. Probably it's out there. It's 5:30 in this room here, and then Thursday I start the next introductory course on a Thursday evening, 5-week introductory course for mindfulness. So if anybody wants to get the basic instructions for our practice again, they can come then. Yes?
What is the date for the death and dying?
Oh, and then May 17th and 18th, the evening of the 17th, Friday evening, and all day from like 9 to 5 or so, I forget. On Saturday, Paul Haller, a Zen priest and a friend of mine from San Francisco, and I are going to do kind of a workshop or a kind of whatever we call it, on death and dying from a Buddhist point of view, in this room here. And it's for our Sangha. We haven't advertised it, you know, outside, so. Yeah.
Is that going to be, do you have to be a real experience? We're going to do long sittings, or?
There won't be long sittings. There won't be long sittings in silence. There'll be some sittings that are guided.
Oh, okay. It starts when? At Friday p.m., you said?
Friday, as you're in the brochure, maybe 7 or 7:30. It's so like an evening event and then Saturday during the day. So if anybody has any more flowers they'd like to bring up, who came in the back, And does Owen want to come up and join this celebration? Mm-hmm. Owen, do you want to come up here and help with the ceremony? You come up here. You come sit here with me. And you sit here? Do you want your mother to be up here too? Or your father? Would you come sit here in front of me? So what we're going to do, Owen, at some point, we're going to take the ladle and we're going to, see the water here? We're going to go and wash the baby Buddha like this.
Wow.
Okay? So I'll tell you when you're going to do that. And in the meantime, what the rest of us are going to do is we're going to chant some of the traditional chants that are done on a day like today. And they are, day like this, we take refuge. We chant the names of we pay homage to the Buddha. We take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And we're supposed to take the precepts. So I'll recite or say the precepts in English, and you can join in and repeat them. And I'll say the precepts in two parts, so just follow in. And I thought I would read to you the person who kind of leads the taking of the precepts. At the end of the precepts, that person is supposed to read or chant in Pali. This is a translation into English. That you should have morality as a vehicle for your happiness. You should have morality as a vehicle for your good fortune. You should have morality as a vehicle for liberation. Let your morality, therefore, be purified. So you can chant after me. And maybe most of you know enough of the chant that I'll just do a line at a time. And those who don't know it can pretend. It's the intention that counts. So, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato. You can start, maybe. Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Sangam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangam Saranam Gacchami. For the sake of our practice,
for the sake of our practice,
I vow not to take life.
I vow not to take life.
For the sake of our practice,
for the sake of our practice,
I vow not to take what is not given.
I vow not to take what is not given.
For the sake of our practice,
for the sake of our practice,
I vow not to say non-truths.
I vow not to say non-truths.
For the sake of our practice,
for the sake of our practice,
I vow not to misuse sexuality.
I vow not to misuse sexuality.
For the sake of our practice,
for the sake of our practice,
I vow not to abuse intoxicants.
I vow not to abuse intoxicants.
Anicca vata sankara upaduvayo dhammino upakituva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. All things have the nature, all conditioned things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Those who understand this deep truth will live in happiness. Thank you. Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Owen.
So each of you, as you wish, those of you who want, can come up to bathe the baby Buddha. And as you bathe it, it's usual to come up, if you don't have to do this, but it's usual to bow before you pour the water over. And when you bow to the Buddha, the baby Buddha, you can either be bowing to the Buddha, whatever that means for you, or you can bow to yourself, because the Buddha also is supposed to be yourself. You're supposed to find the Buddha within yourself. And so can you find that within you that is the potential or the possibility of joy, of happiness, of friendliness, compassion, of freedom and awakening, and bow to that? Or you can bow, the bow can be a bow to your fellow Sangha, for the whole community. Just you're bowing to the people who support our practice, all of us together. So thank you all very much, and now there's some refreshments.